Hello and welcome to the Martian Drive-In podcast number 98. My name is Terry Frost, and as you listen to some 1970s Russian space disco in the background, this time around I'm going to be looking at two very interesting films that are quite recent, and one of them is very kind of split on the way that the audience has reviewed it, and the other one is going to piss off some people who are very religious. The first one is from 2015 and is called No Men Beyond This Point, and it's kind of a feminist cautionary tale in a weird kind of way. The other one is The Brand New Testament, a Belgian film from 2016, which posits a slightly different theology than most Christians would recognize. So sit back, I'm going to get the contact details out of the way and fade down the Russian space disco, and we'll get on with the show. Martian Drive-In Podcast is a fortnightly podcast of science fiction, horror, fantasy, and film appreciation. It doesn't matter when it comes from, whether it's old or new, in black and white, in colour, 3D, anamorphic, it doesn't matter. If it's interesting, I'm going to give it a go. Now, there are occasionally also roundtable discussions where I get a few like-minded cronies around and we talk about science fiction or horror or fantasy or anything that takes our mind, so the format's kind of loose. Now, you can contact me and leave feedback via feedbackpaleo, that's feedback, P-A-L-E-O, at gmail.com. You can go to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook and have a chat there with me and other people about science fiction, fantasy, horrors, or any other kind of things you want to talk about. Apart from politics, I've got another area for that. Please be aware that this podcast does have swearing in it. So if you're going to be listening to it on speakers, make sure there are no children around, unless you want them to learn wider vocabulary than they already have. Hey, how's everybody going? The sun is actually shining through the window of the man cave at the moment, so that's quite nice, and it's at least keeping one of my legs warm. Just doing the usual thing, real life, hanging out until Doctor Strange comes out, watching some good media, playing a little bit too much Xbox, and I'm starting to decide I've got to look after my health a little better than I have. So more exercise and a better diet, and a brighter future. So that's the direction I'm going to be heading in over the next, 20, 30, 40 years, depending on how long I live. So if you're in America, by the way, a hell of a lot of sympathy to you guys. It's nearly over now. The silly man is going to go away. Nobody's coming to take your guns from you. And the world will keep going around the sun as it always has. But it has been an incredibly weird year. In a lot of ways, I mean, people are saying about all of the famous people who have died and how rotten 2016 is. And for me, it hasn't always been the best year either. But the good thing is, in a few months, there'll be another one. There'll be one of those artificial and human-defined junctions where after that, you can have the hope for a new year, and I hope it is a fantastic new year for everybody. But there are going to be years like 2016 occasionally. Not everything is sunshine, lollipops and rainbows. But on the other hand, if it was, you'd be bored shitless. So speaking of being bored shitless, one thing that didn't bore me shitless, in fact, was I'm starting to watch the first three episodes of the third season of Charlie Brooker's Black Mirror on Netflix. And to be honest with you, they're good. I think there's one particular standout episode. I think the third one really works, and it's a gut punch of an episode. The first one I like a lot as well. Second one, not so much, maybe because I didn't like the protagonist in it. But I'm looking forward to watching the rest of them, and kind of like when somebody gives you some really, really good chocolate. You want to have a little nibble now and then, you don't want to eat it all up at once. And that's the way I'm feeling about Black Mirror at the moment. I think it all works as good fiction, and I think that in a couple of instances, it works as good sociologically based science fiction. The pundits tell me that the next episode I'm going to watch is going to be the best of them, which means I probably should skip that one and save it for last, the way you do your favourite bit of a meal. But, I've been enjoying that. That's kind of really working for me. I've watched the starts of the new seasons of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. and Arrow and The Flash. And I've watched the first three episodes of Timeless, which is kind of starting to get interesting. In the third episode, it kind of does a couple of things to redeem itself. And the arc of the season begins to become apparent. But I think I'll persist with that one for a few more episodes and just see how we go with it. There's always that horrible thought when you get a couple of week episodes early in a season of a new show. And you go, has this jumped the shark already? And you're not sure. But sometimes there can be that redemption in the third, fourth, fifth episode. So we'll wait and see. I really don't know at this stage whether it's going to be one that I'll persist with. But I will let you know. So movies. What movies have I been watching since the last time I put the headset mic on? I watched a favourite Mammoth movie of mine, which I hadn't watched for about a decade. I've got it on Blu-ray and I like it a lot. And it's Heist, which has Rebecca Pidgeon, Gene Hackman, Delroy Lindo, Danny DeVito in it. It's, as the name suggests, a crime movie. And it's a pretty good one. I like the twists and turns. I like the beautiful dialogue that Mamet has in it. And I like the way the characters think, which is always something interesting with a David Mamet film. The characters don't think like movie characters. They think like people who live in a very kind of contained world. And it's quite fun just kind of visiting the Mamet land and watching that. I think it's one of Hackman's better later roles. Of course, Unforgiven being the best one. But I think in this one, he's kind of sharp and good. And Delroy Lindo gets some nice bits. And Rebecca Pidgeon's very good in it as well. It's from about 2001, I think. Even though I do have it on Blu-ray, it turned up on Netflix, so I just clicked into it and had a good time with it. There was a movie I was going to do for the podcast, but I kind of thought not. And let me know if you want me to do it later. It's House of Frankenstein from the 1940s, which has Boris Karloff, Glenn Strange playing the Frankenstein monster, John Carradine, and Lon Chaney Jr., of course, playing the Wolfman. It's one of those, it's not one of the better Universal movies, horror movies of the 1940s, but it does have its moments. It's got Lionel Atwill and George Zucco in it, and all of the usual cast of characters. It has peasants with pitchforks and torches, and gypsy caravans and beautiful gypsy girls and all sorts of other bits in it, but it doesn't seem to hold together. It's one of those scripts that really, you know, it just doesn't hold together as well as even a good script from the 1940s would. So I found that slightly disappointing, and so I wasn't going to talk about it. The other thing I saw was a movie which bears some similarity in a way with one of the movies I'm going to talk about in this podcast. It's a 1939 French movie called, in translation, The World Trembles. And it's about a kind of sociopathic scientist who invents a machine that will accurately predict to this hour, when to the minute even, when you will die, whether it's by accident or by natural causes. You sit it in front of his machine, and the machine will tell him when you will die. Now, this causes immense ructions. It causes the stock market to crash. Insurance companies, of course, have a problem with it. And it stars Claude Dauphine, and it's also got Eric von Stroheim in it. And you've got to like a movie with Eric von Stroheim in it, where Eric von Stroheim isn't the villain. Claude Dauphine is the villain. The only thing I remember seeing him in, there's a couple of things. He was in a Hammer movie, a Hammer crime movie from the late 1950s. But the only other thing I remember seeing him in is he played the President of Earth at the start of Barbarella. Now, the movie works really well. It's got some, it thinks through its premise really accurately. Some people who find out that when they're going to die react well to it and improve their lives. Other people have less positive reactions. But it's an interesting concept, even though scientifically it's bullshit, of course. But the concept of it really does work. And the filmmakers, Henri-Georges Clouzot was one of them, the guy who did Le Diabolique in the late 1950s, was one of the co-writers. And, I kind of enjoyed it. It really does, even though it's got the usual love triangle kind of thing as a part of the film, it really does follow through on its premise in an interesting way. And it kind of has a little bit of a feel in a way of 1930s science fiction movies like The Tunnel and Things to Come. It's got a little bit of a feel of that to it. There's a kind of, There's a certain ambience that comes with a 1930s science fiction movie that posits immense changes to the world, which this movie, The World Trembles, has a little bit of as well. It really kind of, I found it on a torrent site because it's not available by any other means. And it was quite enjoyable. It's good to see the history of science fiction films, and not only from an Anglophone point of view, having a history of science fiction films and a bit more knowledge about them from other languages always kind of invigorates my love of the genre, and that's never a bad thing. So anyway, I'm going to take a break, and when I get back, I'm going to talk about the more recent of the two films, The Brand New Testament. It's a Belgian film from 2016. Catherine Deneuve is in it with a very unusual love interest. And in a way, it's a whimsical little film that reminds me just a little bit of movies like Amélie.
Tombe la neige, tu ne viendras pas ce soir. Tombe la neige, et mon cœur s'habille de noir. Ce soyeux cortège, tout en larmes blanches, l'oiseau sur la branche. Sortilège, tu ne viendras pas ce soir. Me crie mon désespoir. Mais tombe la neige, impassible ma neige. La pas ce soir. Tombe la neige, tout est blanc de désespoir. Triste certitude, le froid et l'absence, cet odieux silence, blanche solitude. Ce soir, me crie mon désespoir. Mais tombe la neige, impassible ma neige. Mais tombe la neige, impassible ma neige.
That was Tombe la Neige, The Snow Falls, by Salvatore Adamo, which actually appears in the movie I'm about to talk about. The French title of it is Le Tout Nouvel Testament, or The Brand New Testament in English. It was written and directed by Jaco van Dormael and co-written by Thomas Gunzig, and it's kind of a look at Christianity and about human nature and about how God's daughter rescues the world. The tagline for the movie, which appears in the French version, is God is alive and he lives in Brussels, and he does too. That's basically where the movie starts. We see the creation through the eyes of a very different theology. God lives in an apartment with no front door in Brussels. He lives there with his daughter, Aya, who's 10 years old. His wife is very browbeaten. And himself, his son, JC, used to live there, but he went off into the world and came to a bad ending, as we all know. God runs the world from his office, which is basically a large room with a whole bunch of drawers going up to the sky inside it, and an old DOS computer where he puts in commandments and laws for the way the universe runs. Things like whenever somebody gets into a bathtub, the phone will ring, and that if you have butter and jam on a piece of bread, if you drop it, it'll always go face down. All these petty, nasty little laws about how the universe runs. For instance, the next queue always moves faster than the queue you're in. That's one of God's laws. I think it's about number 1552. God's not a nice person. He browbeats his wife. He physically beats air with a strap. And the world, as a result of this, is not a nice place to live in. And Ea decides that what she's going to do is escape and help out. Now, her brother JC, with whom she has conversations because there's a little Jesus Christ statue in her room with whom she has conversations, decides that Jesus had 10 disciples and her mother's favorite number is 18. So she decides that if she can go out in the world and find 6 disciples of her own, then the balance of power will shift and her mother will become God rather than her father. But to do this, she has to stir things up a bit. So one day when her father is sleeping off the beer that appears miraculously in the refrigerator every time, Mrs. God, basically the goddess, opens and shuts the refrigerator door. He's sleeping it off on the couch. She steals the key to his office, goes in, and does one thing on God's computer. And that is she text messages everybody in the world the exact day, year, day, minute, and second when they're going to die. They all get text messages, except the people, of course, who don't have phones. But it does cause a lot of ructions. People react differently to it. One guy looks at the text, sees he's got 2 seconds to live, and gets hit by a truck while he's driving. Things like that. It's a whimsical little film with some serious themes in it. So Ea goes out into the world, and there's a neat little escape hatch, which is in she's got to set the washing machine to a certain setting, crawl into the washing machine through a long tunnel to a laundromat in Brussels, which she indeed does. And she meets a homeless man on the street. His name is Victor, and he's going to write the New Testament as Ea finds her 6 disciples. And so she wanders around Brussels looking for her 6 disciples, and ultimately she finds them. She finds a beautiful, reclusive woman who lost her arm in an accident when she was a child and feels that nobody loves her. She finds a man who hates his work and his life and has decided to never move from a park bench now that he knows the date of his death. She, her third disciple is a sexually frustrated man who's awkward with women and is kind of has an ID fix on a German girl he once met as a boy. And Ea helps him reunite with that woman in an interesting way. The fourth apostle is a man who's fascinated with death and killing and decides to become an assassin because anybody he kills, he knows for a fact it's their time to die. So he's kind of off the hook there. The fifth apostle is an elderly woman trapped in a loveless marriage, played by Catherine Deneuve. And her husband knows that he will outlive her by many years, and so their marriage is pretty much over and that she's got 5 years to live. And the sixth apostle is a sickly little boy who discovers he only has days left to live and decides to live them as a girl. There's a little bit of implication with the little boy, whose name is Willie, that his mother's doing a bit of Munchausen syndrome by proxy on him, which is kind of a bit nasty. There are some very dark little undercurrents in this film. But Ea gets together her 6 disciples and decides that they are going to change the world by shifting the balance of power from God, who follows her to Brussels and ends up as a homeless man in a refuge run by a church. And Ea decides that she's going to change the world by tipping the balance in favour of her mother, the goddess, if only her mother realises that things have changed. And the way that she sees things are changing is there's a picture of the Last Supper up on the wall in the apartment. And every now and then another apostle will appear, apart from the 12 that were already there. And so her mother, played by an interesting actor called Yolanda Moreau, who was also in Amelie, is quite fun in this film. I really like her. She doesn't get a lot of dialogue and doesn't say a lot. But along with Aya, played by a young actor called Pili Groen, she's just a lovely creation. God's played by Benoit Poelvoorde. It kind of travels through Brussels. The different people meet each other and become friends, and in some cases lovers. The lovely thing about this is that there's a whole bunch of different people here. There's an elderly woman in a loveless marriage, Catherine Deneuve playing that, who falls in love with a very inappropriate being. I'm not going to spoil that one for you. You've got Willie, who decides he's transgender because he's only got a few days left to live. You've got a guy fascinated with death who finds an excuse to live. You've got a guy who visits prostitutes and strip clubs because he's lonely and just wants some kind of human contact, who ends up finding his one true love in a very unusual circumstance. I like this film a lot. I don't have any investment in Christian theology from a belief point of view. It's just where I am and where I came from and where I'm going as well. So I can kind of see this as not necessarily a satire of Christianity, but a kind of re-examining through a lens of magic realism. And one of the neat things that the filmmakers do as well is they set out right from the start that there's no afterlife. When you're dead, you're dead. There's no heaven. There was a Garden of Eden, and that turned out to be Brussels, and we see God's first attempts to create the world, where he basically creates the city of Brussels without people in it. And he tries a few things. He tries to populate it with giraffes, which we see, which doesn't quite work. And then you get ostriches and chickens and other things, and eventually he decides to create Adam and Eve. And the nice thing about Adam and Eve is that they have those kind of black censorship rectangles around their genitals, but they're actually in the real world. So when Adam bumps the black rectangle, it moves. And Eve's the same way. So the theology is set up. And the visually, this movie is fascinating visually. There's some beautiful shots there. It's one of those films that I think, for me, CG was made for, because it helps the storytelling. Having an empty city of Brussels with giraffes wandering through it, and a tiger sitting on a bed watching a TV screen, and a cinema full of chickens watching a cartoon about chickens, it sets things up beautifully, whimsically. And then later on, as the story progresses, the CG helps us with the story in a number of ways. It's just, we know it. We know it's not real. We know it is CG, but it's used in a whole bunch of different ways that enhances this kind of magical realm that Aya walks through, in which the ghost of the fish you had for dinner swims around your head singing La Mer in the voice of Charles Trenet. And all sorts of other weird and wonderful things. There's a silverback gorilla in there as well. There are any number of other people. And there's a really odd kind of stuntman daredevil guy called Kevin. Kevin finds out he's going to live another 90 years. And so he keeps throwing himself off buildings just to see how he's going to survive, and videotaping it for YouTube. So at first he jumps off a tower and lands on a truck full of mattresses. First he jumps out of a building and lands on another guy who dies. Then he jumps off a tower and lands on a truck full of mattresses. He jumps out of an aeroplane and lands on another aeroplane. And we see him, by the way, there is a post-credit sequence with Kevin in it, which is quite interesting. So this isn't a movie to be taken seriously. It's kind of charming and whimsical. It does have a bit of nudity in it. It has sadness, happiness, joy, sorrow, true love, sex, romance, people examining their lives. It has a fantastic sequence where one of the characters, the guy who sits on the park bench, has a conversation with a bird through the mediation of air. And he and the bird decide they're going to wander off and have an adventure and travel the earth. And so this man just walks across Europe up to the Arctic Circle with at first the bird and then a whole flock of birds in a shoal, one of those great formations of birds flying overhead, as he walks across Europe to his final destiny. And that's, it's a magical sequence. They keep cutting back to the guy walking through different bits of Europe and really getting his shit together and getting his life together by doing the things he knows he should have been doing all the time. And there's a wonder and a magic in this film. I really like it a lot. I'm sure that if were to get a wide release in America and Australia, there'd be people up in arms and there'd be a lot of pitchfork and torches happening about this film. But I don't think it's about that. I know a number of Christians who'd love this film and who appreciate the fact that their belief system can be seen as a vehicle for telling some quite charming and beautiful stories, even though it's not in the way that these sort of stories are normally told. And one of the things about the CG too is there are little bits of it that kind of work and little bits of it that don't work. But we're so invested in the characters and so invested in the magic of the story that it doesn't really matter that much. And Ayo asks people interesting questions. She collects their tears because she's found out that she can't cry herself, so she collects the tears of other people. And she hears music in the heartbeat of everybody. And when she meets the disciples, she rests her head against their chests and tells them which classical music piece or which song their soul is attuned to, in a sense. And that in itself is a good opportunity to incorporate music into a movie like this. And it is, and all of the songs that she tells people their body sings is appropriate to the character. And that's kind of, yeah, I like it. I like that little conceit. I like a little conversation about Proust the two of the characters have in a recording booth, in an audio recording studio, which I started reading Proust, and so it's kind of consistent with what I know of Proust's work. And I kind of like that. I like the way they slide that in there, not to be smarty pants, look at me, I'm reading Proust, but to find a way for two characters to engage based on a mutual regard for a certain writer. All this kind of works for me. The Brand New Testament is a lot of fun to watch. It really does have, yeah, if you're in the right sort of mood, it'll be a good date movie, as long as you're not dating somebody who's at the extreme end of Christianity. I think it'll be a great date movie for anybody. It's just whimsical, charming, a lot of fun. It goes places where we don't expect it to go. The asshole God we have in this is so much of an asshole that he mocks modern Christianity in such a way that a priest basically tries to kick the shit out of him. So we've got that there. And God comes to a kind of amusing and appropriate comeuppance in Uzbekistan, of all places. So just to wrap this up, check out some genre stuff that's not in English is the kind of takeaway for this one. There's a lot of good stuff out there. Keep your ears and eyes open. Click the links. Take a look at what's out there. Do a few Google searches and find yourself some really fun genre cinema which isn't following the trends of Hollywood. And well, I mean, this movie would never be made in Hollywood for a number of reasons. The theological aspects being the primary ones, of course. But it just is I mean, I've said this before on a podcast. There are too few charming movies in the world. There's a lot of them that will make us feel a lot of things, nausea included. But charming movies are a rare bird. And when they come out and they're not cute and over the top and too self-consciously manipulative, I think they're a lovely little kind of change, palate cleanser, after watching the kind of movies I usually watch, which are lesser films in some ways. But anyway, I'm going to wrap it up there. I really like the brand New Testament, not because it kicks the shit out of the Christianity, because it tells the story well. It has interesting characters in it. And I particularly really love the world that comes about after the goddess takes over things. It's a lot of fun. And really, it's if you get a chance to see it, see it. So I'm going to take another break now, and when I get back, I'm going to talk about a somewhat different film, and in a kind of low-key way, quite controversial. And it is No Men Beyond This Point from 2015, directed by Mark Sauer, starring Patrick Gilmore, Christine Kofsky, and Tara Pratt.
By the end of 1957, three out of four babies born were coming from fatherless impregnation. And every one of those mothers gave birth to a girl.
The government needs to acknowledge it, or they are going to be sorry.
Women take over, and guess what? We live in a world where there's no wars, and no f***.
I'm 37 years old, and I'm the youngest man in the world. I'm going to make the best of the opportunities that I do have, because things aren't going to change.
Excuse me? Can't congregate in groups more than two.
Oh, come on.
They have taken away our place in society. They will not take away our dignity.
We'll see how they get along without us.
Hey, Jackass! You forgot your coat!
Women still crave intimacy, just as we're still pairing off in order to raise our children.
But there are men still out there. Could we just take a small break?
Of course there are women who don't want men to perish, and they're a dying breed.
Just let them die off.
This is an act of nature.
Praise nature.
They are lacing our food with estrogen, which is the girly hormone.
This is just the tip of the iceberg.
We'd already been hiding. This was going to be a lot harder. If we want to change, we're going to have to do something about it.
No Men Beyond This Point is a 2015 mockumentary comedy, which has quite an interesting premise. I think that the fact that they went there is an interesting thing. I've got a really good plot of it from a website called Moria. And it says, ever since the 1950s, there have been a growing number of virgin births. At first, this was denied by governments, but has grown at such a rate that it could no longer be ignored. Moreover, These were all female births. As women came to take over society, men were increasingly regarded as irrelevant. Wars decreased, and eventually men were banished to reservations and fed doses of estrogen to make them more docile, in the hope that they would eventually just die out. A train of thinking has emerged that regards sex as something that women will evolutionarily grow out of. Andrew Myers is the youngest man alive in the world at the age of 37 and works as a domestic servant to partners Tara and Iris and their daughters. As a documentary crew films him, Iris enjoys painting using Andrew as a subject, trying to capture the essence of man. Now, I'm not going to go any further with the spoilers on that one. But I like this film. Now, there's a couple of... out there, there are a couple of different schools of thought about this film. One of which is that it's not funny, and the people who think it's not funny are kind of split down the middle, men and women. And the people who realize that, yes, it's not a perfect film, it's a low-budget film made in and around Vancouver in Canada. And for what it is, it's quite well made. And it is, my feelings on it are kind of clear. It took me a day or two after watching it to kind of figure them out. First off, I can see the weaknesses in it. There's weaknesses from the scientific point of view. If indeed women are all having babies by parthenogenesis, then that means that every woman basically is her own species, because only her genes will be passed down to the next generations and her daughters and her granddaughters and things like that. It doesn't appear, based on the film, that the... pathogenic offspring are clones at all, but the kind of some kind of recombination of the mother's genes. But that's just me overthinking this kind of thing. For this kind of film, the science part of it's not particularly important. There's some really interesting social things in there, apart from the fact of Andrew, who's the youngest man in the world at the age of 37, And he's not living on one of the men's reserves where they get really nice meals, wine, they get to play games and golf and things like that. But they're not allowed out. And the guys are increasingly aging. And eventually it's determined by the World Government Council that they'll just let men die out. Through the mockumentary, we see how things started when there were a few virgin births and women were treated incredibly shabbily. Because, you know, they and their husbands hadn't had sex in a certain time, but the woman nonetheless is pregnant. There were problems with that. There were problems, too, when a bunch of nuns became pregnant spontaneously. And eventually, there was a recognition that this is happening, basically, because the recognition was forced on the authorities, as it were then, by the fact there were fewer male births happening. And, of course, this cause a number of crises. We see a couple of nicely edited clips where both Eisenhower and Churchill talk about the problem, or are perceived to be talking about the problem, by using certain video clips of them out of context, and that's kind of fun. And there are also news and documentary mock footage from the period talking about the situation and what can be done about it. There's the inauguration of the first female president in 1965, which kind of works nicely. And they create this entire alternate universe where things are off kilter. But it's a beautifully defined alternate universe too, because there are no wars anymore. Technological progress, which is often spurred by war, is slower. There's no internet, there are no mobile phones, all TV sets are much smaller and they're in the old academy ratio, and they're all cathode ray tubes. Newspapers are still very big, and the World Government Council also has an education program for women, particularly girls and young women, discouraging them from having any sexual identity. So there's the other side of this thing as well. Not only is there satire about men and the way men are, and I'll talk a bit more about that in a moment, but there's also this kind of soft dystopia. I was going to say utopia, but dystopia, where the World Governing Council is discouraging any kind of female sexuality, and a nature cult springs up, which is kind of government sanctioned, which says that this is all natural and that women are going to evolve out of having a sexual identity and that everything's going to go along smoothly because of that. And that's a creepy concept for women as much as it is for men, because the government's basically putting out a lot of anti-masturbation propaganda and anti-lesbian propaganda, even though that's not explicitly stated in the film. It's what it comes out to be. They want the world to be full of platonic pair-bonded women raising their parthenogenically produced children in a way that the government authorises and condones. Because you've got to remember, this alternate universe split off in the 1950s. And the filmmaker, Mark Sellers, really thought it through. And yeah, lesbianism wouldn't be something that would be condoned in a more conservative social context, even though this world is more advanced than us in some ways. They've cured cancer, they've cured influenza, and they have world peace. Nonetheless, they never use the L word in the movie, but there's some strong implications based on the archival and mockumentary footage that the World Government Council is full of people who are anti-sex of any kind, and that in itself is quite unsettling. And again, this is still a comedy, and there are a number of ways this is demonstrated. For instance, there's a drastic increase in female violence, and what they realise is going on, and this again mocks women's menstrual cycles to an extent, so take it with a grain of salt, is that all the women in the world are synchronizing their cycles, and so they decide that every month is going to be a 3-day holiday. So one assumes that, you know, women might sit on a couch with a hot water bottle on their tummies eating ice cream and watching Oprah, which again is a sexist stereotype, and I did that deliberately just to point it out. So there are aspects of this movie which could be seen as sexist, whichever kind of where you stand on the genre, on the gender spectrum, you can find something to be offended by in this film if you want to. But what it also does is it sets up a really interesting alternate universe. And it also mocks men's right advocates. There's a men's right advocate at one of the camps, an Australian played by an actor called Cameron McDonald, whose name is Darius Smith. And he's kind of, you know, really hardcore male's right things. You know, he wants the world to go back to there being men and women on equal footing, and people should be fucking, and, you know, he has a right to have a life and to have a wife. And he's basically thick as a brick. He's one of those kind of hardcore men's right types who really can't get a plan together for a study. He can't get anybody organized. And all he can do is bitch and moan and whine about things without actually doing anything about them. And so he's one of the more comical characters in the movie. And rightly so, because he's basically a fuckwit. There are a couple of other men interviewed who come across as much more nuanced and kind of intelligent than Darius is. And then we have the kind of core story of Andrew and how he's living in a female society as part of a dying gender. And there are kind of moments of poignancy in that. And though it does soon become fairly obvious that Iris and he have secrets together, even though she lives in a pair bond with Tara, the actress who plays Tara, is named Tara Pratt, so it's Tara, Tara, one or the other. And that kind of pair bond is strained by the fact that Andrew is there because of that increasing attraction between Andrew and Iris. And Andrew's a nice guy. He's had an interesting life because of the situation of being the youngest male in the world. And he's kind of come to a comfortable living circumstance. He enjoys parenting the kids. He's supportive of them. He's friends with them. He likes them. And is falling in love with one of the mothers. And this would be incredibly creepy were it not for the fact that she's falling in love with him as well. And because of that simple thing of a romantic and sexual love, start making some changes to the world when it's finally revealed that they are sleeping together and they do have deep and poignant feelings for each other. So the world they live in is incredibly nuanced, and I really like the world building in this film. Now, the way that the movie polarizes people is men's rights types, and there's one particular troll who's reviewed this movie on IMDb. And if you look through the movies he's reviewed, he's always saying negative things about every film, is that, you know, this is a hate crime, this movie. It's against men, it makes fun of men and, you know, men's rights and men's position in society, and it mocks the nature of men. Of course, this guy on the internet really doesn't realize that movies have been mocking the nature of men since at least Max Sennett days. And the fact that this movie does it in a somewhat different way is neither here nor there. Yeah, it does that, but it also says something about a kind of feminism which doesn't recognize the human need for intimacy. And the World Governing Council is very much of that kind of point of view. It's an incredibly draconian, asexual, and under the surface of it, nasty organization. If it puts men into reserves and gives them estrogen against their will. So basically they're doping people against their will. Even though that is funny, and one of the and Darius talks about the girly hormone that they've been putting into the food. Underneath that, there's a very dystopian concept, and the movie also does that thing of taking things to extreme in the sense that where are the men and women who married before all of this shit went down, or even just as this shit was going down, who want to live together because of their deep feelings for each other, even if the wife is parthenogenically having kids. Yeah, where are those people in this equation? The movie kind of posits a situation where because they can't have children with the men, the women instantly find the men of no value. Now, that's a, that's an extreme circumstance, and it's done for comic effect. But it's a pretty dark and dystopian concept, and not particularly realistic. And you've got to remember, too, that we're seeing this movie through the lens of the mockumentary. So we only see what the filmmakers of the mockumentary want us to see. We do see some of the negative stuff about the society, but we don't see all of it. And that's kind of interesting, too. This is a very layered film. So men's right MRAs, basically, are going to hate this movie because the men in the movie end up living in men-only reservations, playing golf, eating really nice food and drinking wine, which happens to have estrogen in it. And the women run the world and do, for the most part, on the surface of things, a pretty good job of it. There are no wars. They've cured cancer, and there's a kind of thin veneer of utopia over the underlying dystopia. And of course, I'm not trying to dismiss for a second the fact that there are asexual people out there. There are asexual straight people, there are asexual gay people, there are asexual bi people. But for a government to try to impose that on a mass populace is something else entirely. The movie, it's a lot of fun, and it's one of those movies that wouldn't get funding for a large budget because of the nature of its subject. But nonetheless, it's a very polite Canadian movie in some ways. For instance, even though there are the men's right activists and things, if you were looking at a real-world situation where this was kind of occurring, there'd be such a horrible wave of terrorism going through the world that it really would be a nastier place to live in than this movie posits. I was just trying to kind of do the Gedanken experiment in my own head. What would happen, and what would happen with things like ISIS in the modern world, if suddenly women were reproducing parthenogenically and producing only girl children? And it's not a pretty scenario, but this movie, because it is kind of a light mockumentary kind of thing, doesn't really go into those areas because it would weigh the movie too heavily towards seriousness rather than comedy. And the comedy is kind of whimsical rather than broadly satirical. It's not a black comedy in any sense. But it does have its moments. I kind of liked it for that reason. I liked it because it's an original film. Even though there are other works that have kind of touched on the Last Man on Earth kind of situation. And there have been a number of them too. There's Why the Last Man on Earth comics. There's Houston, Do You Read? By James Tiptree Jr. There's Wyndham's Consider Your Ways. Herland from 1915, apparently. There's a book called Herland in 1915 by Charlotte Perkins Gilmore. There's the British-German... I'm reading this from the Moria site, by the way. There was Star Maidens from 1976, which was a really bad science fiction TV series as well. So the concept's not particularly new, but I think that putting it into the mockumentary format and making it not a serious film, but, you know, a light, slightly whimsical film where true love sort of prevails in a way, and the not very sharpened blade of satire points in both directions. It's mocking a certain kind of feminism. It's mocking a certain kind of, well, extreme feminism. It's also mocking an extreme kind of men's right type person. Though there aren't too many mild men's rights activists out there, because most of the men I know realise that men's rights is something that's happened about 35,000 years ago. But just to wind up, you can find this one on Australian Netflix, which probably means that you can find it on American and Canadian and British Netflix as well. It's only 2 hours long, so it's not really going to suck up all of your day to watch it. And I found it kind of interesting. I think that there are some missed opportunities in the film. And maybe that's partly because of the budget limitations. And you've always got to consider those sorts of things in this kind of a film. But, I like to see more films like this. I like these small films that I keep finding on Netflix and other platforms, which are telling stories in different ways and kind of telling the kind of, you know, interesting science fiction kind of stories. On Netflix as a platform and as an independent film, because studios just wouldn't understand what the filmmakers were trying to do and wouldn't finance it even if they did. As with Jennifer Pong's movie Advantageous, which is probably my poster child for this kind of Netflix movie. Streaming platforms are opening up opportunity for independent film that cinemas and even DVD and Blu-ray releases haven't previously given much love to. And this is great too, because even while the big boys are out there making billions of dollars on single movies, single tentpole movies every year, small films like this, through Netflix and through other means, really do deserve a bit of air and a bit of oxygen, and it'll also give the filmmakers the opportunity to make future projects if people watch these films. Not every filmmaker is going to get the opportunity to make a Marvel film, and nor should they in some cases, but these small, whimsical, not perfect, you know, nicely done little science fiction films deserve a bit of love as well. So anyway, that's about it this time around. It's a slightly short Martian Drive, and I nearly said Paleo Cinema, but I didn't quite. So again, thank you for listening. Thank you to the Patreon subscribers and all their help. Thank you to the two carriers who subscribe and support the podcast. Thanks to everybody who says nice things about the podcast. We got a little bit of Twitter love for Paleo Cinema the other day too, which was quite nice. So if you do like the podcast, even if you don't send me anything saying you like them, then if you do like them, put it out on your Twitter stream, put it out on your Facebook, just do something like that, because it does help us. Put in the reviews on iTunes, because they also help and get more people to listen to my ramblings about obscure Belgian theological movies. Anyway, take care of yourselves. I'll be back next week with number 199 of Paleo Cinema. I'll be back in 2 weeks with number 99 of Martian Drive-In podcast, and then we get into the big number. I will be doing something for them, but I ain't sure what yet. Take care of yourselves. Watch good movies. Watch bad movies. Keep watching the skies, and I will be back soon with more stuff. Oh, by the way, next week on the radio, on ABC Local Radio Northern Territory, Rebecca McLaren and I are talking about The Nightmare Before Christmas for Halloween. Take care of yourselves. I'll be back soon. Thank you to all of the Patreon subscribers. And here are the credits in the style of movie credits to acknowledge and thank all of them. We have Tom, our focus puller. Sarah, our special effects technician. Ian, our caterer. Grant, our technicolor consultant. Claire, our script doctor. Gary, our prop master. Morris, our music director. Jan, our dialect coach. Armin, our key grip. Matt, our rattlesnake wrangler. Elaine, our scientific advisor. Julia, our casting director. Chris, our camera operator. Christopher, our gaffer. Miss Jane, the wardrobe mistress. Tansy, the foley artist. Alyssa, the location scout. Mark, our second unit director. Paul, our special makeup effects director. Tammy, our donut wrangler. Tim, our New York unit director. Rabbi Steve, our spiritual advisor. Steve, our script doctor. Dylan, our goat wrangler. Eric, our set security lead. Kerry, our second script doctor. Richard, our set photographer. And our extras, Kathleen, Mark, and David. And let's not forget Steve Sullivan, our director of monster effects. And Richard C., our transportation co-captain. So thank you very much to all the subscribers. And you too can subscribe at patreon.com/paleocinema.